I want to talk about a story in the Bible that is often affiliated or associated with suffering and grief and loss. Now, if you are in my Wednesday night class, you're going to have to endure something that you've already heard a little bit about, okay? I already know of somebody that's going to be taking a short nap while I speak this morning. Any luck yet? Not yet. Keep going. Okay. So if you're in my Wednesday night class, some of this is going to sound a little bit familiar to you, but I'm going to be speaking this morning from the book of Job, which is in our Old Testament, right before the book of Psalms. So if you want to go there and be following along. This book is the oldest book in the Bible, yet the story is universal. The story of Job has timeless appeal and application. Now, we generally know chapters 1, 2, and 42. We know how the story begins, and we generally know how the story ends. But most of us don't know about, as Paul Harvey would say, the rest of the story. Most of us aren't really familiar with the back and forth and the struggle and the wrestling that this character goes through. For many of us, our familiarity with Job is limited to James chapter 5, verse 11, which unfortunately in many English translations was translated or mistranslated the patience of Job. A better word might be perseverance. An even better word might be endurance, because Job wasn't exactly a picture of patience. So we're going to read a little bit of the story and then talk about a little bit of the story and then try to make some application to us today. So I'm going to read a pretty big chunk of this at the beginning. So follow along with me. If you've got it on your electronic device, we're going to begin in Job chapter 1, verse 1. In the land of Uz, there lived a man whose name was Job. This man was blameless and upright. He feared God and shunned evil. He had 7 sons and 3 daughters, and he owned 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, and 500 donkeys, and had a large number of servants. He was the greatest man among all the people of the East. His sons used to hold feasts in their homes on their birthdays, and they would invite their 3 sisters to eat and drink with them. When a period of feasting had run its course, Job would make arrangements for them to be purified. Early in the morning, he would sacrifice a burnt offering for each of them, thinking, "Perhaps my children have sinned and cursed God in their hearts." This was Job's regular custom. So this is a good guy, okay? This is a good guy. This guy is almost the picture of perfection. And he is such a good guy that he even serves in the priestly role for his family. Okay? He's offering sacrifices on behalf of his children just in case they've had an improper thought in their heart. Okay? So this is a good dude. Now, verse 6, the scene changes. One day the angels came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came with them. The Lord said to Satan, "Where have you come from?" Satan answered the Lord, "From roaming throughout the earth, going back and forth on it." Then the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job? There is no one on earth like him. He is blameless and upright, a man who fears God and shuns evil." Here's the key to the entire story in verse 9. Does Job fear God for nothing? Satan replied, "Have you not put a hedge around him and his household and everything he has? You have blessed the work of his hands so that his flocks and herds are spread throughout the land. But now stretch out your hand and strike everything he has, and he will surely curse you to your face." The Lord said to Satan, "Very well then, everything he has is in your power, but on the man himself do not lay a finger." Then Satan went out from the presence of the Lord. Scene changes again. One day when Job's sons and daughters were feasting and drinking wine at the oldest brother's house, a messenger came to Job and said, "The oxen were plowing and the donkeys were grazing nearby, and the Sabaeans attacked and made off with them. They put the servants to the sword, and I am the only one who has escaped to tell you." While he was still speaking, another messenger came and said, "The fire of God fell from the heavens and burned up the sheep and the servants, and I am the only one who has escaped to tell you." While he was still speaking, another messenger came and said, "The Chaldeans formed three raiding parties and swept down on your camels and made off with them. They put the servants to the sword, and I am the only one who has escaped to tell you." While he was still speaking, yet another messenger came and said, "Your sons and daughters were feasting and drinking wine at the oldest brother's house, when suddenly a mighty wind swept in from the desert and struck the four corners of the house. It collapsed on them, and they are dead. And I am the only one who has escaped to tell you." At this, Job got up and tore his robe and shaved his head. Then he fell to the ground in worship and said, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I will depart. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. May the name of the Lord be praised." In all this, Job did not sin by charging God with wrongdoing. So we've had a scene on earth, we've had a scene in the heavens, we've had another scene on earth, and now we're going back to the heavens. On another day, the angels came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came with them to present himself before him. And the Lord said to Satan, "Where have you come from?" Satan answered the Lord, "From roaming throughout the earth, going back and forth on it." Then the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job? There is no one on earth like him. He is blameless and upright, a man who fears God and shuns evil. And he still maintains his integrity, though you incited me against him to ruin him without any reason." "Skin for skin," Satan replied, "a man will give all he has for his own life. But now stretch out your hand and strike his flesh and bones, and he will surely curse you to your face." The Lord said to Satan, "Very well then, he is in your hands, but you must spare his life." So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord and afflicted Job with painful sores from the soles of his feet to the crown of his head. Then Job took a piece of broken pottery and scraped himself with it as he sat among the ashes. His wife said to him, "Are you still maintaining your integrity? Curse God and die." He replied, "You are talking like a foolish woman. Shall we accept good from God and not trouble?" In all this, Job did not sin in what he said. When Job's three friends, Eliphaz the Temanite, Bildad the Shuhite, and Zophar the Naamathite, heard about all the troubles that had come upon him, they set out from their homes and met together by agreement to go and sympathize with him and comfort him. When they saw him from a distance, they could hardly recognize him. They began to weep aloud, and they tore their robes and sprinkled dust on their heads. Then they sat on the ground with him for 7 days and 7 nights. No one said a word to him, because they saw how great his suffering was. This is a good guy. This is a good man. This is a man of integrity, a man of character, and a man of faith. But this is a man of whom the accuser says, "He only serves you because of what you've done for him. He only serves you because you've blessed him. He only serves you because you've protected him. He only serves you because he's healthy. If you take away everything that he has, he will curse you to your face." So Job is a good guy. Satan, the accuser, comes into the presence of God and slanders his integrity, slanders his character, and so, for lack of a better phrase, there's a bet. There's a wager. God says, "Okay, try him and see." And that's what happens. According to the story, Job has immeasurable loss. He loses everything. He loses his servants. He loses his livestock. He loses his children. He loses all of his property. He doesn't lose his wife, though he might have wished he'd lost her. Why don't you just curse God and die? You know? He might have said, "Oh Lord, why is she still here?" But, you know, we only have what we have in the story, right? He loses everything. Yet in all of this, he does not curse God. He does not blame God. The story, the text says he does not sin in what he says. Then at the end of chapter 2, we're introduced to three friends: Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar. Now, the bulk of the book is a poetic rendering of the dialogue between Job and his friends. Okay? The majority of the book is a poetic rendering of Job and his friends going back and forth. Okay? They're trying to explain to him why he's going through everything that he's going through. And they're trying to offer him advice as to what he needs to do. And as they do that, Job becomes more and more entrenched in the idea that he has done nothing to deserve what he's going through, and his friends aren't really comforters at all. That's what the bulk of the book is about. But initially, the friends have good motives. They hear about the troubles that had come upon Job. They set out from their homes. They leave their homeland to go meet together and to sympathize with him and comfort him. When they see him from a distance, they don't even recognize him. He is in such bad shape. They begin to weep aloud. They adopt symbols of mourning. They tear their robes. They sprinkle dust on their heads. And when they get to Job, they sit in silence. Now, according to Jewish tradition, this is somewhat normal. To sit in silence with someone that is mourning is a normal thing to do. What is not exactly normal is the fact that they sat in silence for 7 days and seven nights. So the friends come to Job. They've adopted the signs of mourning. They sit on the ground with him for 7 days and for seven nights. Nobody says a word because they are shocked. Chapter 3, Job curses the day of his birth. After 7 days and seven nights of silence, Job has had enough. And he literally calls down a curse upon the day of his birth. He wishes that the day that he was born could be erased from the history of the universe. I don't know that we can even begin to grasp the pain and the misery that someone that has experienced this degree of loss would be feeling. We know about loss in our own lives, and we know the misery and the loss that we feel in our own lives when we hurt and when we grieve and when we suffer. This is almost beyond our ability to comprehend, and maybe that's the point. And so after 7 days and seven nights, he curses the day of his birth. And once he does that, then that gives the friends permission to speak. But they're a little bit surprised at how Job has spoken. And so they set about to correct him. They set about to set him straight. And every time one of them speaks, Job responds. And the more that they speak, the longer his responses get. And the more they speak, the worse comforters they become. He even tells them that. He tells them, "You're miserable comforters. You're like a doctor that's a quack. You're of no help. You're of no good in this situation." And there rises to the surface a legal metaphor, and Job eventually begins to speak of taking his case directly before God. "The friends are no good. I want to take my case directly to God, though I know that I am not worthy to stand in the presence of God. Therefore, I need a redeemer. I need a goel. I need a stand-in to represent me before God." That's the whole gist of the major part of the story. Now, eventually, guess what happens? God shows up. God shows up. But God does not show up in the way we might think that God would show up. God does not show up and wrap his metaphorical arm around Job and say, there, child, everything's going to be okay. God does not show up and say, I'm sorry that all this has happened to you. God does not show up and say, well, let me tell you, Job, it was really all about a bet. God doesn't do that. God shows up and basically says, Job, who do you think you are? Who do you think you are? Now, David Gallagher has a phrase for this, but I don't know if we can repeat it out loud. Basically, God says to Job, be a man. Suit up and show up. We're going to have a talk. It's really not that bad of a phrase. I just can't remember it right now. We're going to have a talk. Job, who do you think you are? Job, where were you when I created the heavens and the earth? Where were you when I created the sun and the moon? Where were you when I put the stars in the sky? Where were you when I created all of the creatures that are on the earth? Where were you, Job, when I was creating nature and the cycles of life? Where were you when all of this was being done, Job? Who do you think you are? God shows up, but God shows up in a way that is quite unexpected. Now, how the story turns out is that Job has a life-changing experience. His encounter with God changes his life, changes his perception, changes his outlook and his attitudes, to the point that his losses are restored twofold. His losses are restored twofold. God tells the friends, he doesn't really appreciate what they've said about him. They've not described him accurately. In fact, God says, my servant Job, and that's a phrase we find over and over and over, my servant Job, he will offer sacrifices for you. He will pray for you. And I will accept his prayer and not deal harshly with you. Job has his fortunes restored, and God gave him twice as much as he had before. The Lord blessed the latter part of Job's life more than the former part. That's the Cliff Notes version, the Reader's Digest condensed version of the story. So, as friends, as comforters, as helpers, there's a thing or two we can learn from this. Knowledge is not the key to effectiveness. Just because we think we know a little doesn't mean that we know it all. And it's not our business to have an answer for everything. The issue with the friends of Job was that they thought they knew God. They thought they knew the ways of God. They thought that they could speak for God and offer an explanation on God's behalf. And while they were a little bit right in their theology, they weren't entirely right. And even though they were a little bit right, their little bit of rightness was not helpful to someone that was suffering to the degree that Job was suffering. So as friends and comforters and helpers, knowledge is not the key to effectiveness. And just because we think we know a little doesn't mean we know it all. And it's not our business to have an answer for everything. To those of us that are in the midst of grief and sorrow and pain, there are no words or actions that will fix our situation. There are no words or actions that will take the pain away, that will reverse time to the way things were before, or that will fast forward time to a better point in life. That just doesn't happen. So when we're in the midst of anything that is hurtful or harmful, there are no words, nothing that anybody can do that will fix it. We cling to the good. We cling to the moment, one day, 1 hour, sometimes 1 minute at a time. To those of us that are friends and comforters and helpers, the best way to walk along someone sometimes is just to be quiet. The best way to walk alongside someone is just to be quiet. Even if you think you're right, even if you think you have an explanation, even if you think God needed another flower in his garden, even if you think this is all a part of God's wonderful plan, even if you think all of that, and even if there's a measure of truth to any of that, don't say it. Because it is not helpful to the other person. It may make you somehow feel better about yourself, but that's not what it's about now, is it? So sometimes let's just shut up, even if we think we're right. And for those of us, again, that are in the midst of grief and sorrow and pain, we need to know that sometimes, most of the time, there is no explanation. Suffering is something that we experience as a part of life. It's not necessarily something that has to be explained. Many times it can't be explained. I will tell us this. I will remind us of this. It is the faith that we have as a foundation. It is the relationship that we already have with God before the terrible happens. It's the faith that we have as a foundation. It's the relationship that I already have with God before those terrible things happen that sustains us during those awful moments. If I don't have any faith to start with, if I don't have any relationship with God to start with, my awful moments are going to be awful. My terrible times are going to be terrible. But if I have faith as a foundation, if I have a relationship with God, then when the awful comes, when the terrible happens, we can then endure the experience. And when we come out on the other side, we can look back and we can realize that we're stronger and that we're better and that we're humbled and that we're hopeful in a way that we were not prior to. When we come out on the other side, we know that everything indeed belongs. That everything belongs. Everything is a part of God's work. And we know that everything that comes at us in this adventure called life has the potential to help us become more and more into the person that we were created and intended to be. And I can almost guarantee you, without exception, that those in this room that have the closest walk with God, that have the deepest relationship with God, that have the closest spiritual conscious contact with God, are those that have been through immense suffering and hardship. I can almost guarantee you that. Because that's just how it works. Now back to Job real quick. The central message has been thought to be twofold through the years. Why do the righteous suffer? And how do we demonstrate faith and perseverance in the midst of suffering? Those have been two questions that have been forced on the grid of the story of Job for centuries. But I would argue that those may be legitimate questions, but they're not really the heart of the message. They're not really at the heart of the story. The heart of the story is about motive. The heart of the story is about Job's motivation for serving God. Remember chapter 1, verse 9. Does he serve you for no reason? That's the question of the story. And so the question for us is, why do we serve God? Why do we serve God? Do we do so because of how it benefits us? Do we do so just because it's what we've been brought up to do? It's just what, you know, I've always done, go to church. I've just always done this. But why? Why do we serve God? Do we do so just because of how it benefits us? Do we do so so that we can go to heaven when we die? Do we do so so that we can avoid hell when we die? Do we serve God so that our life on earth will just kind of generally be better? Or maybe we buy in to the conventional wisdom of the day, which says, if you're blessed, it's because God is honoring you. And if something's going wrong in your life, it's because God is punishing you. You see, the story of Job says that's not always true. But the heart of the story of Job is the question, why do we serve God? It's a good question for us. One final reminder, chapter 42, beginning at verse 1. Then Job replied to the Lord, I know that you can do all things. No purpose of yours can be thwarted. You asked, who is this that obscures my plans without knowledge? Surely I spoke of things I did not understand, things too wonderful for me to know. You said, listen now and I will speak. I will question you and you shall answer me. Listen, folks. Verse 5. My ears had heard of you, but now my eyes have seen you. Therefore I despise myself and repent in dust and ashes. My ears had heard of you, but now my eyes have seen you. We might say of that verse, I thought I knew you. I thought I knew about you. My ears had heard of you, but now my eyes have seen you. I thought I knew about you intellectually, but now I have experienced you. Knowledge is wonderful. Knowledge is important. But knowledge about God is not nearly as important as experiencing God. Job thought he knew about God, and so did the friends, until he actually experienced God in a way that changed his life. And that experience came out of times of immeasurable suffering and heartache and pain. The same God wants us to experience Him as well. He wants us to experience Him in a life-changing way. And most of us in this room have a degree of intellectual knowledge about God. But I wonder how many of us have actually had an experience with God. Many of us have gone through some pretty hard times in life and have come out of those on the other side with a faith that is immensely stronger than the one that we had before. You don't have to do all of that. If you're willing to turn your will and your life over to God, maybe suffering and pain and hardship doesn't have to be a building block for your faith. But it certainly can be. So if we're helpers, let's walk alongside people in silence. Let's love and let's support. If we're suffering, let's look to the God that is the ground and the source of everything, that made everything that we know of, and that also made us, and wants to have fellowship with us. Let's resolve to live our life for Him. Not because we get anything out of it, just because He is. If we can pray with you this morning, pray for you this morning, we encourage you to come forward as we sing the invitation song. If you've never begun this walk with Jesus, this relationship with God, we want to encourage you to give that serious consideration as well. If we can help you, if we can talk with you, study with you, whatever it is, just let us know as we stand and as we sing.